You and I back together again on Thursday, May 26th, 2022, right here on Connecticut Today. We welcomed William B. Allen. He's the editor of a new book of essays, The State of Black America. He talked about issues facing African Americans in the U.S. Motor Transport Association of Connecticut head Joe Scully came back on the show. He talked about, of course, the current diesel fuel crunch and other issues facing the state's commercial truckers. Right now, though, we welcome a gentleman who has put together a series of essays in a book called The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. Our next guest is a resident scholar and former chief operating officer at the Center for Urban Renewal and Education in Washington. He's also an emeritus professor of political philosophy in the Department of Political Science and emeritus dean of the James Madison College at Michigan State University. And back in 2018 to 2020, he was a senior scholar in residence at the University of Colorado Boulder. We welcome William B. Allen to the program. William, hi. It's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I am well. It's certainly good to be with you.
How do you fit all that on your one business card, William? That's a pretty good, resume there. I like that.
It's just a matter of letting the years pass you by.
I guess. Now, you culled a very interesting set of essays, and I've read some of them here. The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. Boy, that is a title, William. I mean, we could talk, people could talk about this for hours and hours. You look in this book, this collection of essays, correct, at the past, the present, and the future. Talk a little about that.
Well, you've summed it up. It is the past, the present, and the future, because it's so important for us to know that in the period after slavery, the picture is far more complex than is usually reported to us. We often today hear it described as a period of darkness, but in fact, in the first 30 years, from 1860 to 1890, the rate of family formation was extraordinary for freed slaves. The population itself doubled, an incredible rate of growth. By 1920, literacy had attained 50%. Schools, thousands of schools had been created. And most of this effort, though it was supported by friends, benefactors, philanthropists, especially from the North, most of it was self-generated by the freed slaves themselves. It was their initiative, their sense of agency. And that set in motion a progress that had sustained itself well into the middle of the 20th century and that demonstrated the capacity, the resilience, the strength of the United States to serve as a forum on which American blacks could demonstrate that they were indeed full participants in this society.
Now, William, some people would hear that and in the black community and also in the white community and say, who is this guy kidding? Does he not see what's going on around us? Or, William, are those people only seeing what they want to see and see a different narrative out there?
Well, I'm afraid that they're not looking at what happened. They're looking at what has been imagined. And certainly what has been rhetorically inculcated, because we've been subjected to a poison that's been injected into the veins of the culture. That poison comes in the form of racism with a capital R. It is constantly preached from the top of the White House all the way down throughout the major institutions of the society. But it's false. Yes, there are racists, but there is no longer a racism with a capital R. And that never did define the American promise. So the story has to be told from the beginning. It has to be shown the way Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells did in 1893, who went back to 1619 in order to contrast it with the accomplishments post-slavery. And they were protesting, you must remember, protesting being excluded, black people being excluded from the Chicago World's Fair. And they said, excluding us is excluding the story of the accomplishments of the United States. Because what we have done because the United States, and we're here, and we're making progress here. And that has continued to be the case. One day, in the mid-60s especially, people were told equal opportunity is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Lyndon Johnson said that. And what he was saying to black people in particular was, you can't do it. But all that period of time, post-slavery up until then, 100 years, black people were proving they could do it. And so the distinction is not black and white. The distinction is between people who actually have a sense of agency, who do participate, and those who don't. And the ones who don't participate, don't have a sense of agency, have been victimized because they were persuaded from the 1960s on to think of themselves as dependent victims.
William B. Allen has put together and edited a group of essays, a collection of essays, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. William, hang on. We'll be right back to you. William B. Allen is the guest. And when we come back, I'll ask William his thoughts as to the debate going on today in not just upper education and law schools, but now into the lower grades about things like the 1619 Project, critical race theory, and all of that. More with our guest, William B. Allen. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. A collection of essays available at Amazon, wherever you get your books. The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. And this has been edited and put together by William Allen, who continues with us. So, William, let me get your view on this whole thing from afar and close up as well. The controversy over CRT, what we call a woke society now, the 1619 Project. Are we tossing around the race word or racist or American being racist just too much here? Is it being tossed around now like, you know, candy out of a bag or something?
Yes, I would say it's worse than candy out of a bag. It's poison out of a needle being injected into the veins of the culture. The purpose of it is to divide. It is not, in fact, to clarify. It is not to tell the truth. It is to, in fact, obscure the truth of American history in order to undermine the claims of America to respect in the world. So that this is a conscious project by people who prefer to think of this system as one that deserves to be overthrown rather than one that deserves to be defended. The book is a book that has multiple perspectives. There's a debate in the book, and the debate in the book is really between those who say that black communities across the United States have been harmed by government intervention and it should come to an end, and those who say government intervention hasn't done enough and should do more.
Mm-hmm.
And we put a debate in front of people because we think people can judge it when they see an honest debate. But things like the 1619 Project are not a debate, and they're not honest. They are, in fact, false stories, whether about the Founding Fathers or about the overall history of the country. And the biggest lie they tell is that the cancer in the United States, in American culture, was the culture. Slavery was a cancer in the body politic. It was not the body politic. And the cancer was perceived and removed with radical surgery. And now, 150 years later, we can say we're in remission. And that's the story 1619 Project tries to deny.
So who is injecting, if you will, William, this poison? I mean, are these leftists? Are these people? Is it jealousy? Is it anger? Because a lot of these people, William, who I see do this, are not exactly paupers. They are people who are prominent. They have achieved great status, monetarily and otherwise. So why are they doing this? Who's doing this?
There are two groups, and I don't want to foreclose the possibility that there's goodwill in at least one of those groups. But there are two groups, and one of those groups is a group that says this is the way to achieve power, by dividing and conquering. And so the more division you can seed into the society, the more electoral constituency you can assemble, hopefully to attain a majority in your corner so that you become the one that is powerful. That's a group for which there should be no respect. There's another group for which there can be respect, but there must also be recognition. And that's a group that thinks America is fatally flawed and should be overthrown. Those can be people of goodwill. They're radicals, yes. They're far left, yes. They're socialist left, yes. But they at least honestly believe that the system itself needs to be destroyed. And one must give them credit for their belief, even though one must recognize that their belief is false. The premises are false, and the supposed future that they envision is false.
Let's look out finally, William. Let's go 10, 20 years, maybe a full generation 20 years from now. What do you foresee? And hopefully you've plugged in your crystal ball for this question, but what do you see in the next generation of black leadership and maybe black political power and influence in the U.S., say, over the next 20 years or so?
I would say by the year 2050 to 2060, either we will have seen a resurgence of black patriotism, and with it, therefore, a renewed vitality for the United States as a whole, or you will see the country teetering with even worse division than it has known until now, because we are now poised between those two choices. And I would say that over that period of time, at the level of culture and society, what you're going to see, and this is what is presented in the book in great detail, and I hope people will look at these charts and the census readouts and other things that are included in the book, you're going to see an American culture that is going through a period of great absorption. This is denied by public leaders who try to exploit and manipulate divisions based on race. But the reality is we are, in fact, rapidly advancing towards a society in which all the different elements constituting it are being absorbed into the American mainstream. That's the critical thing. That's what the future holds.
And the name of the book, it is a collection, as William said, of very good essays, opposing points on many things in there that you could read and debate for yourself. The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. We have been speaking with William B. Allen. William, we thank you so much. Good luck with the book, and hopefully we can touch base down the road. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome, and I thank you.
Thank you, William. Bye-bye. William B. Allen, a long, as we read earlier, collegiate resume, an educational resume, social scientist. This isn't a book he wrote, but he pulled together essays on particular topics of interest to and pivotal to black culture from the future, heading back toward the era of slavery in this U.S. The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. I'm looking at it right now, hardcover and Kindle editions available on Amazon. And what we don't want to say are probably some of the words that truckers say when they look at the price of diesel today. Good God. And again, remember, diesel users aren't getting that little 25-cent gas holiday that the General Assembly so graciously gave us toward the end of the session and last toward the end of the calendar year. And speaking to those truckers, return visit from a guy we like to check in with every so often, Joe Scully. Joe heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, the group that looks out for the interests of folks who use trucks in the state, from a single truck to a few to a whole fleet to big rigs and all that. Joe Scully, it's Paul here again. Sir, how are you? Good afternoon.
Paul, thanks for having me back. Great to be here.
Joe, what are your members saying about diesel prices, man? Oh, my God. I look and, you know, you think regular gas prices are bad. I tell people, check the diesel, not just for truckers, but for many of those truckers who are using, you know, lawn equipment and things like that, construction people. I would imagine your members aren't happy at all.
Yeah, diesel prices are soaring. And just to kind of add insult to injury, you referenced it a minute ago. We didn't get a tax cut. In fact, we're going to get a diesel tax increase come July 1. That's because state law mandates that the cost of the diesel tax is calculated every year based on a couple of factors, but one of them being what was the average price of a gallon of diesel in the previous year. So mm-hmm. because it was so high, that means the tax rate is going to go up. That's added to the high cost of diesel itself, which is north of $6 a gallon, all-time highs, and that's if you can even get it. We're flirting, if not actually experiencing, diesel shortages in the Northeast. So any way you break it down, the use of diesel is causing a lot of problems right now. And diesel, it just powers nearly every truck on the road. And also a lot of the barges that are out there are powered by diesel, too. So the whole supply chain is being hit by this.
So if there's no diesel, Joe, the barges and the trucks, they don't run? Do they just sit idle there and wait? How does that work if they can't get fuel? I know it's a dumb question, but...
You can't run. Now, here's why that's either happening or we're at risk of it happening. The war in Ukraine, Russia's war against Ukraine, and there's been so many dominoes that fell because of everything that's gone on over there. But the point is, there's a huge demand for diesel over in Europe. And diesel that, for example, would come up the pipeline from the Gulf of Mexico to New York, it gets there, but then it's sent over to Europe. Mm. Or barges that may come into New Haven are sent over to Europe. Now, I am told that situation should correct itself and start to go the other way within a week or two. Supplies in the Northeast should be replenished, and there may even be some kind of price relief in the next couple of weeks. But as always with gas and diesel, things could change. It might not. I mean, our members would love to see a break again to get somewhere below $6 a gallon, which would still be at insane highs. But why should people care? As we often discuss when I'm on with you, is costs that trucking companies incur are ultimately passed on to consumers, because everything that we buy was transported on a truck, and trucking companies operate on thin profit margins. They don't have room to just absorb shocking price increases, whether it's from a diesel or a tax or a toll or what have you. So people should care, and I think they are experiencing the price of high diesel. That's just one factor that's leading to high prices at the grocery store or at the gas station or to have things delivered to you. This affects everybody, not just trucking companies.
Joe Scully is the guest. He heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. Check him out online, mtac.us. Joe, stand by. We'll be right back with you. We'll get more into the fuel situation also. What's up with all these companies asking for truckers, $5,000 sign-on bonuses, $7,000, $10,000? Are younger truckers going to be able to drive those big rigs more? With our buddy Joe Scully coming up first, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. We continue a couple of more minutes every so often. We check in with Joe Scully from the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, watching out for the truckers and what's important to those men and women. MTAC.us, MTAC.us. Joe, before we get into more of the cha-cha, the legalities and driver shortages and all that, what's this I see? The 71st Connecticut Truck Driving Championship coming up June 11th. What's that all about?
Yeah, this is back for the first time since COVID was here. We couldn't hold this event for the last 2 years. The Truck Driving Championship is a great source of pride for the best, safest truck drivers in Connecticut. They come on their day off. It's the second Saturday in June to show that they have the most knowledge about federal regulations or how to do a pre-trip inspection on a truck, or I think most people's favorite part is the skills course. You drive around a very complicated skills course and you show, you know, I can take this turn the closest without actually hitting the obstacle, or I can back up a 53-foot tractor trailer. So, and we have great support from law enforcement because ultimately the event is about safety and they're about safety. So we come together to support that. So I'm looking forward to having this event come back and looking forward to having our law enforcement partners there as well.
Yeah, very, very cool. This will be the FedEx facility, 130 Old Country Circle in Windsor Locks, June 11th. Joe, what's the situation with this driver shortage, Joe? And I know that there was allusions on the federal level to open up the ability for younger drivers to maybe drive the big rigs and the top load weights, because I guess there just aren't enough drivers out there. What's an update on that?
Well, I'll tell you, there was a provision that passed in the federal infrastructure bill about 18 to 21-year-old drivers, because the obstacle, if we want to call it that, is you cannot drive a commercial truck in interstate commerce if you're under 21. So there's a provision that will change that. A lot of people were nervous about it. There's no reason to be nervous. And I would say there are so many safety checkpoints, safety requirements involved in it. And there are so many hours required of the apprentice, the younger person driving the truck under the tutelage of the instructor, that it's actually going to be hard for most small and medium sized businesses to take advantage of it. The larger trucking companies may dedicate time and staff to training a younger driver. And even that is only with the approval of an agency of USDOT. So it's a very limited program. We're working on some other things here. We supported a couple pieces of legislation that passed that aimed to recruit new truck drivers, one of which we worked on with other groups, CBIA, the ACLU. There's a nonprofit that is involved in it. We're going to have people who are nearing the end of their term of incarceration in prison. They'll be able to study and take the commercial learner's permit while in prison. So that way, when they get out, they can immediately go to a CDL training school or to a trucking company and learn on the job to go get tested and get their CDL. We also made scholarship funds available through MTAC. So we're trying anything and everything. We're in the early stages of it, but I'm encouraged by all of these things that we have going on right now.
Very nice. And Joe, I don't blame you for doing this, because I'm seeing stories, not just ads, but news stories, you know, popping up on my feed. You know, Amazon increasing and FedEx increasing big rig drivers, sign-on bonuses, 80, 85, 90 grand after a couple of years. So the jobs are out there, correct?
The jobs are out there, and I'll tell you, the pay is out there. A number from my national affiliate talks about if you drive for a private company, which is most of our members here in Connecticut, the average pay, now this is a national number, but I suspect Connecticut is right there. You can make $80,000+ as a truck driver driving for a private fleet. So look, you can get your CDL at a fraction of the cost that you could for going to a four-year college or university, and then you'll make more money on the other end too. So look, it's a hard job. You got to be focused and dedicated, and you can't use drugs, including marijuana. That's a big issue that's out there these days. But it's not only a great job, but a great career. And most of the jobs in Connecticut, you're home every night too, by the way. You're not gone across the country with the small businesses that we have here in Connecticut. So there's a lot that, you know, we as an industry offer to people if they're interested in these jobs, in my opinion.
Okay, the website for the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, mtac.us, mtac.us. Joe Scully, Joe, good to hear from you. Have a good next few months, and we will definitely check in down the road. Keep us in mind. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Paul.
All right, thanks. There you go. So, folks, it's out there, and not necessarily you, but if you know someone who's looking, full-time big rig truck drivers now, 75, 80, 90 grand a year, relatively quickly. Tough job, though. I don't know if I could. Listen, I know a lot of people, you know, they have this dislike for truckers, how they act on the highway. Look, there are bad apples in all businesses. But the men and women that drive those big rigs, special kind of folks. What did I read once? That if every truck stopped in the U.S., every big rig, every 18-wheeler that you see driving loads around, if that happened en masse all at once, the economy would pretty much stop in 3 to 4 days. Think about that. How many trucks are out there? Joe Scully, thank you.